by tribal leaders. 14. You can hear it ring clearly when, for instance, Representative Lamar Smith, a Texas Republican, says it's better to get your news directly from the president. In fact, it might be the only way to get the unvarnished truth. 15. All of this both predates and contextualizes Trump's constant refrain of fake news. Here, too, Trump isn't a break from recent Republican traditions but a logical extension of them. An interesting question is why the right didn't build institutions similar in ethos and practice to the ones they sought to replace, just sta-ed with conservatives. In 2009, Tucker Carlson mounted the stage at the conservative conference CPAC and warned the right that it needed a strong journalistic culture of its own. The New York Times is a liberal paper, but it is also a paper that actually cares about accuracy, he said. Conservatives need to build institutions that mirror those institutions. Riding the hype from that speech, Carlson went on to found the Daily Caller, which has fallen from its initial high ideals and today mixes conservative paranoia with slideshows of hot women 2016 and then to take a prime-time slot on Fox News, where he's the cable news pundit most skilled at catering to white fear of a Browning America. There are examples of strong institutions with conservative cultures in direct competition with the New York Times, the Murdoch-owned Wall Street Journal, for instance, but they exist as exceptions, not as oft-followed models. I don't have a RM answer as to why, but I suspect it re-exits the market available to Carvo, because the mainstream media and academia actually aren't that liberal, because they mostly do put truth-seeking ahead of partisanship, there isn't that much demand for alternatives. The audience that is sociently alienated by mainstream outlets to present a business opportunity is uniformly conservative, and creating a differentiated enough product to appeal to them means creating a product that chooses to cater to conservative identity, rather than a product that routinely confronts it. But the result is that Democrats rely on a diversity of information sources that discipline their ites of fancy, while Republicans rely on a narrower set of media institutions that propel their polarization. There should be a check on this sort of behavior. A party that narrows the sources it listens to is also narrowing the voters it can speak to. And political parties ultimately want to win elections. Lose enough of them, enough times, and even the most stubborn ideologues will accept reform. Democracy, in other words, should push against polarization. But America isn't a democracy. America, the undemocratic in most democracies, writes political scientist Jonathan Rodden in his book Why Cities Lose, the path to victory is simple, win more votes than your competitors. For the Democratic Party in the United States, however, this is often not good enough. 17. As I write these words, Republicans control the White House, the Senate, and the Supreme Court. The only national branch under Democratic control is the House. And yet Democrats didn't just win more votes in the House elections. They won more votes in the Senate elections, too. They won more votes in both the 2016 and 2000 presidential elections. If America was a democracy, Democrats would control the House, the Senate, the White House, and, through those victories, a commanding majority on the Supreme Court. Their weakness is the result of geography, not popularity. The Democrats' problems are, if anything, worse in the states. As Rodden notes, the Republican Party has controlled the Pennsylvania Senate for almost 40 consecutive years, even while losing the statewide popular vote around half of the time. The Republicans have controlled the Ohio Senate for 30 VE years, during which time Democrats won half of the state's U.S. Senate elections and around one-third of the gubernatorial elections. America is not a democracy. Our political system is built around geographic units, all of which privilege sparse, rural areas over dense, urban ones. This is most glaringly true in the Senate, where Vermont wields the same power as New York. But it is also true in the House, due to the way districts are drawn, and in the White House, due to the Electoral College, and thus it is also true in the Supreme Court, which re-exits the outcomes of presidential and senatorial elections. And power, of course, begets power. Republicans use their majorities to pass partisan gerrymandering plans, pro-corporate campaign Nance laws, strict voter ID requirements, and anti-union legislation, and Supreme Court decisions further weaken Democrats' electoral performance. My point here is not that this is unjust, though I believe it is. Instead, I want to focus on the way this system restrains polarization among Democrats and unleashes it among Republicans. To win, Democrats don't just need to appeal to the voter in the middle. They need to appeal to voters well to the right of the middle. In the Senate, 538's Nate Silver estimates the average state is 6 points more Republican than the average voter. 18 So when Democrats compete for the Senate, they are forced to appeal to an electorate that is far more conservative than the country as a whole. Similarly, it's estimated that Democrats need to win a substantial majority in the House popular vote to take the gavel. 19 And the fact that Democrats have lost two of the last VE presidential elections due to the Electoral College, the only times that's happened in American history, signals a growing imbalance there also. Indeed, a recent study by Michael Jarosso, Dean Spears, and Ishanatale Sara calculates that Republicans should be expected to win 65% of presidential contests in which they narrowly lose the popular vote. 20 The voters who hold the balance of power in American politics are whiter, older, and more Christian than the country as a whole. So for all the talk of democratic socialism and all the star power of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, when the dust settled on the 2018 elections, the House's moderate New Democrat coalition swore in 40 new members, making it the largest caucus in the Democratic Party. The GOP's geographic advantage permits it to run campaigns aimed at a voter well to the right of the median American. It's oft remarked that Republicans have lost the popular vote in 6 of the last 7 elections. If they'd also lost 6 of the last 7 presidential elections, they would have overhauled their message and agenda to become competitive again. If Trump had lost in 2016, he and the political style he represents would have been discredited for blowing a winnable election. The Republican moderates who'd counseled more outreach to black and Hispanic voters would have been strengthened. The shock of Trump's unexpected win in 2016 overshadowed his underperformance. Early in the election, Vox took the leading political science models for forecasting presidential elections, weighted them by past accuracy, and, working with Jacob Montgomery of Washington University in St. Louis and Texas A&M's Florian Hollenbach, built a model that incorporated all of them. The result? Given the economy, Obama's approval rating, and other factors, the Republican should have been expected to win about 50.5% of the two-party vote. Trump consistently polled far behind that prediction, and throughout the campaign, we tracked the difference between his polling and the model's prediction. Calling it the Trump tax on election day, it was 3.8 points. What we appear to be seeing is a remarkable example of a major political party blowing a totally winnable national election, we wrote, in one of many assessments shredded by election day. Still, while Trump ultimately won through the Electoral College's intervention, it's very likely that another Republican, like Marco Rubio or John Kasich, would have beat Hillary Clinton with a convincing popular vote majority, and hypothetical polling matchups consistently backed that up. If the election outcome had re-acted the popular vote, Trump and his supporters, today, would be blamed for losing a race Republicans should have won, handing the Supreme Court to liberals for a generation. And make no mistake, a different, more broadly competitive Republican Party is possible. As of the second quarter of 2019, the two most popular governors in the country, Massachusetts's Charlie Baker and Maryland's Larry Hogan, were Republicans in blue states. 21 There is absolutely a GOP message that can command true majorities. But freed from the need to appeal to the median voter, Republicans have hewed to a more conservative and confrontational path than the country would prefer. They have learned to win power by winning land, rather than by winning hearts and minds. Republicans know that their coalition is endangered, bulletinated by demographic headwinds and an aging base. And that has injected an almost manic urgency into their strategy. Behind the GOP's tactical extremism lurks an apocalyptic sense of political stakes. It feels to many that if they lose, they may never win again, and perhaps, with their current coalition, there's a kernel of truth in that. Still, there is nothing more dangerous than a group accustomed to wielding power that feels its control slipping. In their book The Tea Party and the Remaking of Republican Conservatism, Theda Skocpol and Vanessa Williamson report that it was this sense of desperation that powered the Tea Party's Obama-era rise. "I want my country back," one Massachusetts man told us in 2010. "We need to take our country back," echoed a Virginia woman the following year. This plaintive call is perhaps the most characteristic and persistent theme in grassroots Tea Party activism. As Mark Lloyd of the Virginia Tea Party Patriots explains, people gravitate to the Tea Party when they anguish about losing the nation they love, the country they plan to leave to their children and grandchildren. As a new president of diverse heritage promised to transform America, perceived threats to the very nature of our country spurred many people, and particularly older people, to get involved with the Tea Party. 22 In the run-up to the 2016 election, the conservative Claremont Review of Books published an anonymous, but influential, essay making the case for Trump. 2016 is the Flight 93 election, it said, charge the cockpit or you die. The situation was dire, and there was no guarantee of success. You may die anyway. You or the leader of your party may make it into the cockpit and not know how to why or land the plane. There are no guarantees. Except one: if you don't try, death is certain. The piece went on to blast the conservatives who had spent decades warning of crisis but were sneakily dismissing Trump. Let's be very blunt here: if you genuinely think things can go on with no fundamental change needed, then you have implicitly admitted that conservatism is wrong. This is the mark of a party, a society, a country, a people, a civilization that wants to die. Trump, alone among candidates for high OCE in this OR in the last seven, at least, cycles, has stood up to say, I want to live. I want my party to live. I want my country to live. I want my people to live. I want to end the insanity. 23 The author of this apocalyptic bit of political analysis was later revealed as Michael Anton, and he took a job as a national security OCHAL in the Trump administration. These dire rationalizations permeate the upper reaches of the Republican establishment. When William Barr joined the Trump administration as Attorney General in February 2019, it was a puzzling decision. Barr had previously served as Attorney General under George H.W. Bush, and had settled into a comfortable twilight as a respected member of the Republican legal establishment. The AG position in the Trump White House only opened after the president hounded J.E. Sessions out of OCE for being excessively ethical and insufficiently loyal. But Barr quickly proved himself all that Sessions wasn't, enthusiastically prosecuting the president's vendettas and ying around the world investigating his conspiracies. Why rewrite the end of a storied career this way? Why make this your legacy? Speaking at Notre Dame in October 2019, Barr made his reasoning clear. He argued that the conflict of the 20th century pitted democracy against fascism and communism, a struggle democracy won, and handily. But in the 21st century, we face an entirely different kind of challenge, he warned. America, he said, was built atop the insight that free government was only suitable and sustainable for a religious people. But over the past FTY years, religion has been under increasing attack, driven from the public square by the growing ascendancy of secularism and the doctrine of moral relativism. This is a war Barr thinks progressives have been winning, and that conservatives ght in the face of long institutional odds. The left, he says, has marshaled all the force of mass communications, popular culture, the entertainment industry, and academia in an unremitting assault on religion and traditional values. These instruments are used not only to affirmatively promote secular orthodoxy but also drown out and silence opposing voices, and to attack viciously and hold up to ridicule any dissenters. In a subsequent speech to the Federalist Society, Barr expanded his analysis. So-called progressives treat politics as their religion, he said. Their holy mission is to use the coercive power of the state to remake man and society in their own image, according to an abstract ideal of perfection. Whatever means they use are therefore justi ed because, by definition, they are a virtuous people pursing a deic end. They are willing to use any means necessary to gain momentary advantage in achieving their end, regardless of collateral consequences and the systemic implications. In contrast, he continued, conservatives tend to have more scruple over their political tactics and rarely feel that the ends justify the means. And this is as it should be, but there is no getting around the fact that this puts conservatives at a disadvantage when facing progressive holy war, especially when doing so under the weight of a hyper-partisan media. Again, this was not a random conservative op-ed columnist, but the Attorney General of the United States speaking. In these speeches, Barr sounded like Liberty University President Jerry Falwell Jr., son of Christian right leader Jerry Falwell, who tweeted in September 2018, "Conservatives and Christians need to stop electing nice guys. They might make great Christian leaders, but the U.S. needs streeters like at real Donald Trump at every level of government. B/C The liberal fascists Dems are playing for keeps and many Repub leaders are a bunch of wimps." This is the context for much of the Republican establishment's ultimate embrace of Trump. Whatever Trump's moral failings, he's a ruthless streeter suited for an era of political combat. Rightly or wrongly, many conservatives and particularly Christian conservatives believe that they've been held back by their sense of righteousness, grace, and gentility, and as a result, they are on the verge of being vanquished, and America forever lost. Trump is the enemy they believe the left deserves, and perhaps the only hope Christian conservatives have. Democrats are often derided for playing identity politics, but that is not, in truth, a dearence between the parties. Republicans have built their coalition on identity politics as well. The dearence between the parties is that Democratic candidates are forced to appeal to many more identities, and more skeptical voters, than Republicans do. Successful national Democrats construct broad coalitions, and that's a practice that cuts against the incentives of pure polarization. What national Republicans have learned to do is construct deep coalitions relying on more demographically and ideologically homogeneous voters. Instead of winning power by winning the votes of most voters, they win power by winning the votes of most places. That's let them appeal to an electorate considerably to the right of the median voter, to get away with decisions and candidates that would have torched another party. But it's also forced them into dependence on an electorate that feels its power slipping away, and that demands a response proportionate to its fears. This is the way in which the parties are not structurally symmetrical and thus why they have not responded to a polarizing era in the same ways. Democrats simply can't win running the kinds of campaigns and deploying the kinds of tactics that succeed for Republicans. They can move to the left and they are, but they can't abandon the center or, given the geography of American politics, the center-right, and still hold power. And they know it. In December 2018, well into the Trump era, Gallup asked Democrats and Republicans whether they wanted to see their party become more liberal, more conservative, or more moderate. By a margin of 57-37, Republicans wanted their party to become more conservative, by a margin of 54-41, Democrats wanted their party to become more moderate. 24. This doesn't prove liberals wouldn't exhibit the same behavior toward Obama or Sanders. Just that they didn't exhibit it in the negative toward Trump. Two examples include, this sexy model is blowing up the internet slideshow, this UFC Octagon Girls Instagram account is sizzling hot slideshow, and I kid you not, 13 Syrian refugees we'd take immediately photos, which reads, while a growing list of governors are claiming they won't allow Syrian refugees to enter their states, we think these women might make them change their minds. They are seriously hot. Chapter 10 Managing Polarization and Ourselves. To call a politician polarizing is an epithet, to call a voter polarized is a dismissal. As such, books that explore polarization typically end with suggestions for tamping down our disagreements and rediscovering our common bonds as countrymen. It's stirring stew. I don't consider polarization, on its own, to be a problem. Just as often it's a solution. America's modern run of polarization has its roots in the civil rights era, in the Democratic Party choosing to embrace racial equality and the Republican Party providing a home to white backlash. Surely the polarization that followed that progress was preferable to the oppression that preceded it. In a multi-party system, polarization is sometimes required for our political disagreements to express themselves. The alternative to polarization often isn't consensus but suppression. We don't argue over the problems we don't discuss. But we don't solve them, either. This is not to say American politics is untroubled. But we should be precise in our diagnosis. America's political system is distinct, and in the eras it has seemed to function best, it has relied on mixed parties. Because a less polarized country lies within living memory, the tendency is to imagine a return to an idealized past. This must be the aberration, and that the state of nature. But, as I've tried to show in this book, the polarization we see around us is the logical outcome of a complex system of incentives, technologies, identities, and political institutions. It implicates capitalism and geography, politicians and political institutions, human psychology and America's changing demography. And for now, at least, it's here to stay. Absent an external unifying force like a war, the divisions, or worse we see today will prove the norm, while the depolarized politics of mid-20th century America will prove the exception. And if we can't reverse polarization, as I suspect, then the path forward is clear. We need to reform the political system so it can function amid polarization. I should level with you. I don't like concluding chapters. Authors write whole books about devilishly complex social problems and then pretend they can be solved in a few bullet points. I have more condenke in my diagnosis than my prescription, and what I hope, above all, is that I've oared a framework here that others in politics will use to make sense of our problems and better the system. What follows isn't a comprehensive policy agenda but a set of approaches. I have no illusions about solving social media's tilt toward outrage, the human brain's sensitivity to identity, or the dizzying escalation of political con ICT. My intention here is more limited. What I want to do is oer principles that might help us build a political system that can function amid polarization and that might help us craft our own political identities so we can engage in politics in a way that's better for the country and better for ourselves. But let's start with the system. There are three categories of reform I think particularly worth exploring: bombprung, democratizing, and balancing. Bombprung, we know that one result of our polarizing parties is that bipartisan agreement is becoming harder to achieve. We know that politicians are becoming more responsive to a media that amplifies con ICT and a base that loathes weakness. We know that confrontation and paralysis have become divided government's natural state. Some of that political combat is necessary. Some of that gridlock simply wreaks a divided country. But we should limit the damage it can do. We should, to the extent possible and consistent with political accountability, bomb-proof the government's operations against political disaster. The most obvious candidate here is the debt ceiling. As discussed in Chapter 8, the debt ceiling could take routine bickering in Congress and transform it into a full-blown global financial crisis. Even if you believe neither party truly wants to see a default, assume, and I think this is reasonable, that under current conditions, there's a 5% chance of miscalculation in any given debt ceiling confrontation such that it goes horribly wrong. If you believe that, then you believe, after a few decades, it's likelier than not that we will have defaulted at least once. The debt ceiling is bizarre and unnecessary. It severs Congress's decision to spend money from its decision to pay its bills. We can and should get rid of it. There are plenty of other ways for members of Congress to express their views, gain some leverage, and grandstand before their constituents that don't threaten to tank the global economy and forever wound the world's faith in American treasury bonds. There are other possible candidates here, too. Congress's budgetary process has been broken for years. Instead of passing budgets, Congress typically debates, gridlocks, and often shuts down over the budget's pathetic cousin, continuing resolutions, which carry the previous year's spending over to the next year, with some minor alterations. As a result, long-term school planning is an impossibility throughout much of the federal government. It is properly Congress's responsibility to manage spending, but it is also, in theory, Congress's responsibility to manage it well. Revamping the budget process to make budgeting more automatic, with predictable spending changes that trigger in the absence of a new budget, would be a more sensible way to finance the government and would permit Congress to GHT at less cost to the American people and the services they depend on. Similarly, a lesson of the Great Recession was that the relationship between polarization and extended economic soaring is dangerously dysfunctional. Moments of emergency, like the collapse of Lehman Brothers, might temporarily puncture the system's inertia, but as the crisis drags on, it becomes tempting for the minority party to cease cooperating and commence criticizing the public anger that recessions generate as a potent electoral weapon. An expansion of automatic economic stabilizers OERS a possible answer. As the unemployment rate rises, the federal government can automatically absorb more state Medicaid costs, boost unemployment and food stamp spending, and begin lowering payroll taxes or expanding Social Security checks. Wonks could come up with hundreds of other ideas. But the governing principle is simple: where congressional inaction can do great damage, we should ask ourselves whether the upside of congressional deliberation truly outweighs the risk of unnecessary disaster. Representation is an honored value in our political system, but as I write these words in September 2019, Congress's approval rating in the Ill Clear Politics average of polls is 16.6%, and its disapproval rating is 71.4%, so it's not clear to me that the American people feel all that well represented. Which brings me to the next principle. Democratizing. In the last chapter, I discussed the way exposure to democracy has proven something of an immune system for the Democratic Party, while the Republican Party has been warped by its ability to win elections without fashioning a majoritarian agenda. If we want politicians to adopt a broader and less polarizing approach to both politics and policy, we need to make them responsible for putting together broader, less polarized coalitions. A Republican Party that needed to put together popular vote majorities would be a healthier party, and that would make for a healthier politics. Reinvigorating American democracy would take different forms at different levels. At the presidential level, it would simply mean doing away with the archaic electoral college. This is difficult to do through constitutional amendment but easy to do through legislative action. The National Interstate Popular Vote Compact is an agreement by states to throw their electoral votes to whichever presidential candidate wins the popular vote. It would take legal force the moment states representing a 270 vote majority in the Electoral College sign it, and so far, the states that have joined represent 196 electoral votes, which is more than 70% of the way there. At the House level, this could and should mean something like proportional representation. We're used to states carving themselves into gerrymandered congressional districts, but the Constitution doesn't demand that structure, and other countries don't use that structure. A smarter approach, as Lee Drutman, a senior fellow at the think tank New America, argues, would be to combine multi-member districts with ranked choice voting. Under this system, states would break into electoral zones represented by multiple members of Congress. Voters would list their favorite candidates in order. The least popular candidate would be eliminated, and her voters would see their second choice counted. In, say, a three-member zone, this process would continue until the top three candidates were discovered. This has a few advantages. One is that voters can choose the candidate they like most, knowing their vote can still matter even if their favorite politician loses. Another is that voters would no longer have to live in the small fraction of swing districts for their votes to matter. Parties would have to compete for all voters, everywhere. But the third and most important advantage of a system like this is that it makes third parties viable, as unlike under our winner-take-all election rules, a party that gets 22% of the vote can get 22% of the seats, rather than nothing at all. To see the difference this makes, imagine an election where Republicans have 40% support, Democrats have 45% support, and Libertarians have 15% support. In our current system, that leaves the Libertarians with nothing and their voters likely responsible for the Democrats' victory. That's why systems like ours create two-party duopolies. In a proportional representation system, conversely, that makes the Libertarians the crucial power broker. That's why proportional representation systems foster multi-party democracy. There are some who see multi-party democracy as a cure for all that ails us. I don't. A quick survey of Europe, where multi-party democracy is common and plenty of countries are undergoing their own political crises, is enough to curb expectations. Still, one way of thinking about the mid-century American party system that I've described is that it was actually a four-party system: the Democrats, the Dixiecrats, the Conservative Republicans, and the Liberal Republicans, and it seems to have functioned more smoothly. Perhaps some form of proportional representation could nudge us back in that direction, albeit with less racism. The Constitution makes the Senate harder to democratize than the House. As a Californian, I think the fact that my state gets exactly as much representation as Wyoming is insane. But given our founding design, we're not getting rid of the Senate, so I'll just have to simmer in my discontent. What we could do is twofold. First, get rid of the filibuster, which takes an already undemocratic institution and adds an absurd supermajority requirement on top of it. The old hope that the filibuster would encourage compromise has failed. This is not a controversial point, we have more filibusters than ever and less compromise than ever. But the filibuster's worst sin is that it drains the system of accountability. In theory, the way American politics works is that a party gets put in charge, that party governs, and then voters decide whether they like the results. In practice, the filibuster allows the Senate minority to hamstring the majority. This would be any if voters were all congressional reporters, paid to watch the procedural maneuvering that drives the chamber. But they're not. What they know is that their roads aren't getting XED, their jobs aren't coming back, and Washington doesn't seem to be doing anything to help them. So, reasonably, they blame the majority, even if it's not actually the majority's fault. A system where it's this hard to figure out why something didn't happen isn't a system where voters can act as an effective check on legislators. In an age where bipartisanship is irrational, making it impossible for partisan majorities to govern well simply ensures we'll be governed poorly. Defenders of the filibuster, and they are rife in both parties, will cite all the horrible legislation that the other side might have passed if not for the rule. And true enough. But fundamentally, the question this raises is, do you prefer the problems of governance or paralysis? I choose governance, in part because I trust the American people to ultimately look out for their own interests. Democrats who worry that Obamacare would have been repealed in the absence of the filibuster give too little credit to a country that would have noticed healthcare being canceled for tens of millions of people. Either healthcare matters to people or it doesn't, but it can't both be central to their lives and irrelevant to their politics. Similarly, Republicans who believe the American people would rise up against unchecked liberalism should ask themselves why they're so afraid of permitting the country to see Democrats' true colors. Second, it's long past time for Washington, D.C., and Puerto Rico to have congressional representation. It's one thing for the Senate to represent states rather than people. It's another thing for so many Americans to be deprived of representation because the places they live have been denied statehood for political reasons. We live in a country built on the principle of representation. The fact that we deny it to so many of our citizens is indefensible. The fact that we particularly deny it to places with large African American and Hispanic populations compounds historical injustice and tilts the system toward white voters. If D.C. and Puerto Rico have representation, that would be another push for the Republican Party to veer away from deepening racial polarization as an electoral strategy. Of course, all of these reforms only work if people can actually vote. There's a broad range of ways to make voting easier. I like automatic voter registration and Oregon's vote-by-mail system myself, but more important than the details is the simple principle that voting should be easy, not hard. The harder you make it to vote, the surer it is that only the most polarized Americans end up at the polls. It is disastrous that democracy has become a partisan issue, with Republicans viewing efforts to expand the franchise as conspiracies to weaken their party. It's possible that a more democratic America would be a more democratic America, but it's also possible that a Republican Party that had to compete for more kinds of voters would reform itself to win that competition. As I noted before, the most popular governors in the country are moderate Republicans leading blue states, so there's no reason to believe the party lacks popular appeal when its incentives are properly aligned. There is no less dysfunctional politics without a less dysfunctional GOP, and the path to a less dysfunctional GOP is forcing the party to reach beyond the ethno-nationalist coalition Trump rode to victory. The alternative to democratizing America is scarier than mere polarization, it's a legitimacy crisis that could threaten the very foundation of our political system. By 2040, 70% of Americans will live in the 15 largest states. That means 70% of America will be represented by only 30 senators, while the other 30% of America will be represented by 70 senators. One, it is not difficult to imagine an America where Republicans consistently win the presidency despite rarely winning the popular vote, where they typically control both the House and the Senate despite rarely winning more votes than the Democrats, where their dominance of the Supreme Court is unquestioned, and where all this power is used to buttress a system of partisan gerrymandering, pro-corporate campaign Nance laws, strict voter ID requirements, and anti-union legislation that further weakens Democrats' electoral performance. That would not, in the long term, prove a stable system. If this seems outlandish, well, it simply describes the world we live in now and assumes it continues forward. Look at Wisconsin, where state Republicans gerrymandered the seats to make Democratic control a near impossibility. 2. Look at Citizens United, which gave Republicans a 5 percentage point boost in Indiana elections for state legislators. 3. Look at the Trump administration's effort to add a citizenship question to the census that was designed to scare Latinos away from answering the form. Its architect wrote that it would be advantageous to Republicans and non-Hispanic whites, for too much of American politics is decided by efforts to restrict who votes or, as in gerrymandering, to manipulate the weight those votes hold. A more democratic system won't end polarization, but it will create a healthier form of competition. Balancing this is the principle that will feel strangest to people. It feels, to be honest, strange to me. The threat to the United States of America has always been disunity. At the time of its founding, the strongest and most politically important identities were state identities, and the central tension was between those who feared the white, male, voting public and those who trusted it, so we built a system meant to calm those divisions. We balanced big and small states in the Senate. We balanced Democratic and elite rule by handing the House to the voters, the Senate to state legislatures. Popular elections came to the U.S. Senate only with the 1913 ratification of the 17th Amendment, and the White House, through the peculiar institution of the Electoral College, to both. A central problem in any free political system is how to secure balanced competition. The problem in our system is that what we balanced for is no longer what's competing. Today, the strongest and most politically important identities are partisan identities. We don't talk about big states and small states but about red states and blue states. If there is a threat to American unity, it rests not in the specie concerns of Virginians or Alaskans but in the growing enmity between Democrats and Republicans. And here's the thing, the founders did not think about how to balance parties, because they didn't think parties would exist. If the competing groups are states, you need a set of rules to make sure that competition is fair, says Liliana Mason. If the competing groups are parties, you need a set of rules to make sure the partisan competition is fair. Those who trust in the founders' wisdom need to take this more seriously, if they were wise to recognize that the most potent political units need to be represented in the system in a balanced, predictable way, then the path to honoring their insight lies in correcting their oversight. Perhaps there are places in the political system where, rather than unleashing the parties to GHT to the death for every scrap of power, we should lower the stakes by guaranteeing them or, in a multi-party system, any party that achieves support above a certain threshold equal power. One interesting proposal for this comes from law professors Daniel Epps and Ganesh Sitaraman. 5. They argue that the CONICT swirling around the Supreme Court has reached dangerous levels, with McConnell's rejection of Garland kicking off an anything-goes era in the GHT for control, with Democrats now seriously discussing a partisan court packing as a last-ditch effort to negate McConnell's gambit. Epps and Sitaraman suggest rebuilding the Supreme Court so it has 15 justices, each party gets to appoint VE, and then the 10 partisan justices must unanimously appoint the remaining VE. Until all 15 are agreed upon, the court wouldn't be able to hear cases. This system would have a few advantages. First, it could come a con ICT that is thoroughly politicizing an institution meant to keep at least some distance from politics. Second, it would create a path to serving on the court that would reward candidates who aren't seen as intensely partisan and ideologically reliable, which basically disqualifies you now. In theory, both sides would feel and be equally represented on the court, and the all-out warfare of recent years would ease. Am I sure this would work? No. But I'm sure that what we're doing now isn't working either, and so creative thinking is needed. In Congress, rules could be rewritten to ensure participation and voice that don't rest on the veto power of the lie-buster. It should be easier, for instance, for the minority party to bring full bills to the OR. In the House, the so-called Hastert rule wherein Republicans, and often Democrats, won't bring a bill to the OR unless it commands a majority among their own members denies a vote to legislation that may pass atop unusual coalitions. You could also imagine a right to actual, ongoing debate that is not paired with a supermajority requirement. The underlying principle in all this is that the two parties both represent huge swaths of Americans, and the fact that one has the majority does not mean the other should be deprived of a voice. Depolarizing ourselves, a theme of this book has been that we, as individuals, aren't just responsible for changing the political system, we are also being changed by it. The primary way the system gets its hooks into us is by threatening or otherwise activating our political identities and using the catalytic energy to get us to contribute, vote, read, share, or just generally be pissed off. That's not always a bad thing, of course. Politics is a high-stakes enterprise, and there are plenty of times when we should contribute, vote, read, share, and, yes, be pissed off. But there's a difference between polarization and manipulation. There's a difference between using politics for our purposes and being used for the political purposes of others. So I also want to discuss a few ways we can change our relationship to politics that can be both healthier for us and our country, identity mindfulness and rediscovering a politics of place. Identity mindfulness: all politics is influenced by identity. That's not because all politics is literally identity politics. It's because all of human cognition is influenced by identity, and politics is part of human cognition. We cannot sever ourselves from our circumstances. We will never fully know how fully we've been shaped by our contexts. Who we are, where we grew up, whom we've learned to trust and fear, love and hate, respect and dismiss, it's deeper than conscious thought. The slate of mental processes built around the millisecond it takes an identity to activate isn't something we can simply slough off. But if we can't turn off the power identity holds over us, we can harness it. Remember, our identities are manifold. Republican is an identity, as is Democrat. But so is fair-minded, or Christian, or curious, or New Yorker. It can be as much an identity to see yourself as an advocate for the poor, for animals, or for children as to be a member of a political party. The thing about the organized identities promoted by political coalitions is that there is a massive apparatus for denying, policing, and activating them. If you want to get out of that superstructure, it takes work. But it is possible. If the beginning of wisdom on identity politics is recognizing that all of us are engaging in it all the time, the path of wisdom on identity politics is to be mindful of which of our identities are being activated, so that we can become intentional about which identities we work to activate. Like a muscle or a neural pathway, the identities we use most grow strongest, the ones that lie fallow weaken. We can wield that to our advantage. Doing so starts with mindfulness. Yeah, I know. Of course, the politics book by the liberal Californian Vejan ends with a call to mindfulness. But slowly take 10 breaths, making sure your mind doesn't wander, and hear me out. Our environments are designed to activate some identities and not others. American life is full of American AGS, for instance. Political life is full of reminders of the red-blue divide and which side of it you're on. Religious life is meant to pull you in one direction, hipster consumerism drags you in another, and hey, how about that local sports team whose paraphernalia is literally everywhere? There are massive, well-funded e-orts strengthening our identities everywhere we turn. It takes work to see this happening within us, in real time. But it's possible. The practice of mindfulness is separable from the practice of meditation. Robert Wright, the eminent political journalist and Buddhist scholar, writes, "The word mindful, as used around the time of its translation, meant taking thought or care of, heedful of, keeping remembrance of." In other words, a mindful person is an acutely aware person, a person who proceeds with careful attention to all relevant factors. 6. In this case, the relevant factor I'm urging you to pay attention to is identity. What identity is that article invoking? What identity is making you defensive? What does it feel like when you get pushed back into an identity? Can you notice when it happens? If you log on to Twitter 9 times a day, can you take a couple breaths at the end and ask yourself how differently you feel from before you logged on? The idea here is to become more aware of the ways that politicians and media manipulate us. There are reams of research showing that our reaction to political commentary and information we don't like is physical. Our breathing speeds up, our pupils narrow, our hearts beat faster. Trying to be aware of how politics makes us feel, of what happens when our identities are activated, threatened, or otherwise unaimed, is a necessary RST step to gaining some control of the process. That is not to say we should become afraid of our identities being unaimed or strong emotions being forced forward. It's to say we should be mindful enough of what's happening to make decisions about whether we're pleased with the situation. Sometimes it's worth being angry. Sometimes it's not. If we don't take the time to know which is which, we lose control over our relationship with politics and become the unwitting instrument of others. The point of this book is that we all inhabit a larger context that shapes our actions. Sometimes that context is difficult to change. But sometimes it is changeable. Our informational environments are one of those things. Once we recognize that we exist amid an omnipresent conspiracy to manipulate our identities, we can begin the hard work of fashioning our environment to shape and strengthen the identities we want to inhabit. And I have a suggestion of where to start. Rediscovering a Politics of Place. In March 2018, the New York Times published an article I think about often. Entitled "The Man Who Knew Too Little," it tracked the bizarre world Eric Hagerman had constructed for himself after the election. Depressed by the results, he decided he didn't want to know a thing about Trump. Nothing. It was draconian and complete, he said. It's not like I wanted to just steer away from Trump or shift the conversation. It was like I was a vampire and any photon of Trump would turn me to dust. 7. And so he set out building his bubble. A former Nike executive, he now lives alone on a pig farm in southeastern Ohio. He listens to white noise tapes at the COEE shop. He scolds friends who mention politics. He never looks at the news or social media. He goes to stores early to avoid overhearing talk of current events. When he visited his brother in San Francisco, strict arrangements had to be made. The Sunday newspaper kept out of sight, the TV switched off, his teenage niece and nephew under special instructions. So far, so nuts. But then, at the end, the story changed. Amid his withdrawal, he had focused his time on a master project, one that he thinks about obsessively, that he believes can serve as his contribution to American society. He had purchased 40 VE acres of land that used to sit atop a strip mine. The land became his life's work. He is restoring it, protecting it, turning it into something his community can enjoy. Hagerman, it turns out, hadn't disengaged from civic life. He had simply disengaged from national politics to focus on local change. And he had constructed an informational ecosystem to support that choice. Perhaps he went too far in that project way too far, but most of us are not going far enough. I saw the article because the internet had erupted in outrage over it. The New York Times managed to ND the ultimate beacon of white privilege and, arguably, the most insuperable person in the world, read a representative tweet. 8. Who did Hagerman think he was? This rich white guy who wasn't going to get deported, who wouldn't be jailed, who probably wouldn't suffer at all under the Trump administration. Who was he to tune out the news the second it made him feel sad? But then, who did we think we were? Were those of us sending angry missives into the ether really doing more than this guy who was restoring land to gift back to his neighbors? My point is not that we should all go informationally galt. But I'll be blunt here in a way that cuts against my professional interests. We give too much attention to national politics, which we can do very little to change, and too little attention to state and local politics, where our voices can matter much more. The time spent spraying outrage over Trump's latest tweet, which is, to be clear, what he wants you to do, the point is to suck up all the media oxygen so he retains control of the conversation, is better spent checking in with what's happening in your own neighborhood. There are over 100,000 elected OCHALs in the United States, only 537 of whom serve at the federal level, writes Daniel Hopkins in the Increasingly United States. 9. The 537 federal OCHALs are the ones we have the least power to influence, if only because they have, on average, the most constituents. But we often don't know the names of the OCHALs nearest to us, even though they'd be glad to meet for COE. This isn't because we're lazy, bad people. It's because media has nationalized, and there's been a particular reaping at the state and local level. I don't have an answer for that. Revitalizing State and Local Journalism is a book unto itself, save to counsel E. Ort. It's possible to make local and in-state news sources a bigger part of your media diet and thus make your local political identity more powerful. It's just a lift, particularly when those stories aren't being pushed at you by friends on social media or covered by the national publications you love. But there's a real reward from rooting more of our political identities in the places we live. First, we tend to live among people more like us, so the politics is less polarized. Second, the questions are often more tangible and less symbolic, so the discussion is often more constructive and less hostile. Third, we can have a lot more impact on state and local politics than on national politics, and it feels empowering to make a difference. And fourth, even if your heart lies in national politics, I'm a journalist who covers national politics, I get it. Being involved in state and local politics will make you much more active, both because it's valuable experience and because local OCHALs eventually become federal OCHALs, and they keep in touch with the people they've known along the way. When the next presidential campaign rolls around, the people they're going to want most as volunteers are the folks who already know how to organize in their communities. Again, I'm not counseling you to abandon national politics. But audit your informational diet and ask what percentage of political stories you read are national versus state or local. Watch yourself for a week and reset on how much of your political emotion and energy attached to the national stories. If that mix is overwhelmingly tilted toward the national scene, consider tilting it back. There are no solutions, only corrections. I'll be honest, even writing these suggestions for solutions makes me a little queasy. I began the book talking about mid-century political scientists desperate for more polarized parties. American politics is complex and unpredictable, and sometimes plans that are heralded as overdue solutions in one age become the dinning problems of the next. But then, that's the point, isn't it? There isn't an end state to American politics. The search for a static answer will always be folly. There is no one best way for the system to work. There is only the best we can do right now. And, if we do a good enough job at it, we will see today's successes ossify into tomorrow's frustrations. What works in one era fails in the next. That's okay. The point is to get to that next era with the most progress and the least violence. I get asked often whether I'm optimistic or pessimistic about American politics. I think I'm an optimist, but that's because I try to hold to realism about our past. For all our problems, we have been a worse and uglier country at almost every other point in our history. You do not need to go back to the country's early years when new arrivals from Europe drove out and murdered indigenous peoples, brought over millions of enslaved Africans, and wrote laws making women second-class citizens to see it. Just a few decades ago, political assassinations were routine. In 1963, President John F. Kennedy was murdered on the streets of Dallas. In 1965, Malcolm X was shot to death in a crowded New York City ballroom. In 1968, Martin Luther King Jr. was killed, as was Robert F. Kennedy. In 1975, Lynette Squeaky Fromm, standing about arm's length from President Gerald Ford, aimed her gun and read, "The bullet failed to discharge." Harvey Milk, the pioneering gay San Francisco city supervisor, was killed in 1978. President Ronald Reagan was shot in 1981, the bullet shattered a rib and punctured a lung. For much of the 20th century, the right to vote was, for African Americans, no right at all. Lynchings were common. Freedom riders were brutally beaten across the American South. Police had to escort young African American children into schools as jeering crowds shouted racial epithets and threatened to attack. Violence broke out at the 1968 Democratic National Convention. Urban riots ripped across the country. Crime was rising. The United States launched an illegal, secret bombing campaign in Cambodia. National Guard members read on and killed student protesters at Kent State. Richard Nixon rode a backlash to the civil rights movement into the White House, launched an espionage campaign against his political opponents, provoked a constitutional crisis, and became the RST American president driven to resign from OCE by impeachment proceedings. This is not a counterintuitive take on American history, by the way. Among experts, it is closer to the consensus. The Varieties of Democracy Project, which has been surveying experts on the state of global democracies since 1900, gave the U.S. political system a 48 on a 1 to 100 scale in 1945 and a 59 in 1965. It was only after the civil rights movement that America began scoring in the 70s and 80s, marking it as a largely successful democracy. 10. The era that we often hold up as the golden age of American democracy was far less democratic, far less liberal, far less decent, than today. Trump's most intemperate outbursts, his most offensive musings, pale before opinions that were mainstream in recent history. And the institutions of American politics today are a vast improvement on the regimes that ruled well within living memory. If we can do a bit better tomorrow, we will be doing much, much better than we have ever done before. Acknowledgements. This book is all about how individuals reset the people, communities, and systems that surround them. So, in any proper accounting, the acknowledgements should be far longer than the rest of the text. Since I'm reliably informed that's frowned upon in the publishing world, I apologize in advance to all those left out. And I apologize, too, to all those included. Nothing I say here can possibly do justice to the role you played in shaping this project, and in shaping me. Thank you, RST, to Ben Lonan at Simon & Schuster, who believed in the book I pitched him, and then also believed in the very dearent book I wrote for him, 6 years later. This book would not exist without Ben's faith, patience, editing, and encouragement. My agent, Andrew Wiley, struck a lovely balance between reminding me I needed to get this done without scaring me with how much there was left to do. I hope the wait was worth it. Parts of this book appeared RST as articles in Vox and The New Yorker, and I'm indebted to both the editors who helped shape them and the publications for letting me build on that work here. Ben Callen fact-checked the book with remarkable rigor and cheer. John Sides, Liliana Mason, and Yuval Levin provided crucial comments on an early draft, and John, in particular, has been an invaluable Sherpa to the world of political science, and a dear friend. All of them made this book better, and its remaining mistakes and shortcomings are mine alone. My RST job in journalism was at the American Prospect, where Mike Tomasky took a chance on me, despite my total lack of actual journalism experience, and then took the time to teach me how to be a journalist. Pick up the damn phone or poop, as I came to think of it, rings in my head years later. My community of friends in DC welcomed me into the RST social world where I ever truly felt at home. It meant more to me than they'll ever know. In particular, my roommates at the Hobart House, Ben Adler, Brian Beutler, and Ben Miller, deserve particular note, as do Kate Stedman and Ethan Pollock. I was an unorthodox hire for the Washington Post, and I am forever grateful to Steve Perlstein for convincing them to make it, and for the mentorship, argument, friendship, lessons, and dinners that followed. Thank you to Kelly Johnson for being such a wonderful editor, friend, and con Dante, to Marcus Brochley, Rahu Narisetti, Greg Schneider, Marty Baron, and Donald Graham for modeling so much decency, curiosity, integrity, and kindness. But above all, thank you to the